This week, Honolulu will join cities including Boston, San Francisco, and Washington, D.C., offering the use of a bike for a quick trip of 45 minutes or less for a fee. Bike Share Hawaii opens its Biki stations on Wednesday in locations in the city core. The idea is to bring a bike share program to Hawaii. It has taken a few years to officially launch, and the programs across the country are fairly young, all since 2010. Some Honolulu residents are excited at the prospect. Others, including urban planner and community organizer Wyatt Gordon, are less so. He's critical of Biki's pricing, and he joins us now. Hi there. Welcome.
Thank you for having me today.
So what about a $15 a month fee is unaffordable?
So first off, I just want to say I'm a huge supporter of Bike Share, and I think it's going to be great for the city. But I want to be sure that Bike Share's benefits go to all people who live in Honolulu, as opposed to just tourists and well-heeled residents. So if you think about $15 a month, that doesn't sound like a lot. But if you add that up over the course of a year, that's $180 to use a bike. And for half that, you could own your own bike. And I think most local people just aren't going to use it if that's the price they're set. Especially because on the mainland, average prices are half that, about $85 on average.
Are those the same kinds of programs that we have? I mean, are you really comparing apples to apples when you've got some programs like the cities that we just talked about? Can't imagine getting a bike in the dead of winter. But here, because we have such beautiful weather year-round, it has to operate full year-round.
Yeah, so operating year-round actually increases the profits, which is why Bike Share Hawaii is expected to be one of the most profitable bike share systems in the world, which is a further reason why I think that they can afford to offer locals a good deal and repay the $2 million in public money that went to the system, $1 million from the city and county of Hawaii, of Honolulu, and $1 million from the State Department of Health.
Were you ever involved in any of this as this was ramping up, and you're a community organizer? Did you get involved?
Yeah, I actually volunteered for Bike Share Hawaii for 9 months, and I did a lot of the community outreach, and that's why I'm such a huge supporter of Bike Share. But because it's so close to my heart, I just really want to see it succeed. And in Hawaii, I feel like the problem is if you do something wrong the very first time, then people will never forget it. So I really want them to just do this right and think about the community and make sure that this is a bike share system that all people can enjoy.
You mentioned the fact that they're going to be making some profits year-round, but won't that also go into expansion and need to be able to maintain all of these bikes because they are operating year-round in ways that some of those other cities are only operating, you know, part of the year when it's nice?
Exactly, and cities across the country do use their profits towards expanding, as Bike Share Hawaii will, but cities across the country also offer way better deals to their locals. Bike Share Hawaii is going to be the most expensive system in the world. And the average for the mainland for, when we're comparing apples to apples, unlimited 30-minute rides is only $85 in most mainland cities. And for Hawaii, that'll come out to $180 with this $15 monthly pass. So I don't understand why Bike Share Hawaii has more than doubled the price for our people, especially if you think that Honolulu ranks 107th out of 113th in terms of purchasing power. So that means that a dollar here in Honolulu doesn't go as far as it does in the other cities you mentioned. So here, I feel like there's even more of a moral imperative for Bike Share to get this right and to price it so that local people can use it.
A lot of people might disagree with you that a dollar doesn't go farther in places like San Francisco, because that's a pretty expensive city to live in as well.
Hawaii is actually worse than San Francisco in terms of purchasing power. It is 107th out of 113 cities in the country.
For people who are on a lower economic scale, the idea of having it subsidized in some way and bringing in industry, that's also an idea that we understand that Bike Share Hawaii is entertaining and actively trying to pursue.
As of what I've seen from the pricing information that they've released, I've seen nothing for low-income people, which stands in stark contrast with other bike share systems on the mainland. For example, Boston, New York City, the Bay Area, and Chicago all offer $5 annual passes for low-income residents. And the Washington, D.C. metro area actually gives out memberships for free to low-income individuals.
Because this is such a new industry, and you're talking about, you know, people who are finding their way in a lot of ways to make this work in individual cities, not necessarily just co-opting somebody's model and then trying to replicate it, because we're looking at very, very different cities. Is there something that you see that hasn't yet been discussed at all in any of these cities that you think that bike share is missing?
No, I think a lot of the models that we've seen on the mainland are tried and true. I mean, these cities are extremely effective, and around the world, most cities operate on a pass option. So you can purchase either a daily, weekly, monthly, or annual pass, with the daily, weekly, and monthly passes being more expensive in order to subsidize a more affordable annual pass. Because really only local people are going to buy an annual pass. If you're only here for a week, then you only use it for a few days or what. So tourists who are visiting here can afford to pay more into our system and make it cheaper for those who actually live here to enjoy the amenities of bike share, like greater mobility or having a greener way to get around the city.
I don't think anybody would give you an argument with that, because that's the whole point of having a bike share program. You're looking at a tiered fee structure that would allow tourists and short-term users to pay more than those who would be using it ongoing and need to have it. So what would be a fair thing that you think for Hawaii, given some of the research that you have seen?
So in my article on Civil Beat, Honolulu residents get a raw deal on bike share. I refer to the DPP organizational study. So this was done by Nelson Nygaard and released by the Department of Planning and Permitting from the city. And that suggests a $75 annual pass. And this was further corroborated by a pricing study that was commissioned by BikeShare Hawaii from the University of Hawaii Manoa, the Department of Urban and Regional Planning.
So you're trying to contend that they're making profits that they don't have a right to?
I'm trying to contend that this is in their best interest to offer locals a good deal, because if locals aren't supporting and using the system, then they don't have any allies. We already know that people are really upset in terms of there are going to be bikers out on the streets that are oblivious to our traffic laws, or there might be ADA compliance issues with some of the stations. There's the loss of parking. So a lot of residents are already upset, and they don't know the benefits that bike share may bring them. And I think if bike share wants to be strategic, then they would lower their prices for locals, because they're going to need those allies. If locals aren't using the system and supporting its existence, then the city council or the state legislature could easily seek to cripple Beaky by passing a mandatory helmet law. And a mandatory helmet law actually killed the bike share system in Seattle just this year.
Well, we'll find out more when we talk to them tomorrow. Thanks very much for coming in.
Thank you very much for having me.
Wyatt Gordon is an urban planner, community organizer, and a 2017 German Chancellor Fellow. As treasurer of the Mekulli Mo'ili'ili Neighborhood Board, he'd like to see greater opportunities for the public to shape a more sustainable, livable, and creative city future. Tomorrow, we'll hear what BikeShare Hawaii CEO Lori McCarney has to say.
This is The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio, coming up inside the mind of a film director who explores the dark side of white bread America. But first, your quiz. In today's backyard quiz, we're going to test your knowledge of the highly defensive pufferfish.
When alarmed, these creatures inflate into bristly balls, making it difficult or impossible for predators to swallow. If removed from the sea, this fish is able to inflate with air and are known to make a little croaking noise. This unique defense mechanism somewhat makes up for its slow locomotion. Not only can the puffer inflate, but it's also able to secrete a poisonous substance from its skin, as well as having its organs fill with a toxin that's deadly to humans. Despite the risk, some species of puffer are considered a delicacy in Japan, where licensed chefs prepare them safely. For today's quiz, we're looking for a specific species of this fish found in Hawaii. It's dark brown or black, and it's covered with numerous white spots. Do you know its name? If you do, call us at 941-3689 or 877-941-3689, and the first one to get it right walks away with a prize.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from the National Kidney Foundation of Hawaii, whose Kidney Cars program provides funding for community health and education services. Learn more about vehicle donation at kidneyhi.org.
Aloha, I'm Allison Yaffe from Manhattan, New York. You're listening to The Conversation on member-supported Hawaii Public Radio.
On his 15th birthday in 1963, as one of the nation's most honored Boy Scouts, future filmmaker David Lynch was seating guests at the inauguration of President Kennedy. He seemed the typical product of an idealized Norman Rockwell middle American life. He'd grow up to create some of the most disturbing views of mainstream American life that film and television have seen in recent decades. It's a dichotomy in its character that has fascinated documentary filmmaker John Nguyen, who looks at the director's early life and his art in the documentary David Lynch, The Art Life. The film's showing at the Honolulu Museum of Art later this week, and John is with us in our studio. Good morning, John.
Aloha.
This is really one of the most fascinating filmmakers we've had in the last few decades, in large part because of a sort of a seeming dichotomy contradiction in his character. Do you think that's part of it?
Absolutely. I mean, David Lynch is one of America's leading auteurs.
Yeah.
And I think his themes, like you said, the dichotomy between good and evil, or the beauty of small town America and the underbelly, mm-hmm. is a theme that I see throughout a lot of his works.
Well, most people would know the television series Twin Peaks, typical small town with this grisly murder, and everyone in this on the surface as a, you know, wholesome American type, but everyone with a grim secret, it would seem.
Yes, that's one of the goals of our, you know, people that know David Lynch, he's always very reluctant to talk about the meanings behind his films, mm-hmm. and that's one of the obstacles that we had to overcome when doing a film about David Lynch.
Yeah,
so we had to kind of go about it a roundabout way and focus on his early life to try to get clues, mm-hmm. to understanding his films better.
What kind of clues did you find?
Oh, that, you know, the film opens up where David says that the experiences that he has colors everything that he does in his art and his films. And we hear these little stories about from his youth that really have become scenes in his films.
Mm-hmm. Scenes that he, something that really penetrated really deeply into his consciousness.
Yeah, things that affected him.
And not so much on not so much on a level of thought as on a level of pure experience.
Yes, huh? Absolutely.
So how does one, you know, in later in life as an artist, how does one take, you know, because we all have those childhood, very meditative experiences, but how does that translate into art, you know, that other people can understand or at least be provoked by?
Yeah, I mean, Lynch uses his personal life to gather inspiration from.
Mm-hmm. And so how do you sort of take that, and you know, that's what every artist faces, right? How do I take the things that I feel deeply and make it make sense to someone else?
Yeah, that's what sets David Lynch apart from other filmmakers, I think, is that he's a very gifted artist.
Well, the very fact that he doesn't want to explain his art tells you something about it, that he wants to create this very enigmatic vibe, and he certainly has done that.
Yeah, you know, he likes to leave things open for interpretation, because I think once he explains certain things, then it becomes solidified.
Yeah.
And it's nicer for the viewers to be able to walk out of his films with their own ideas of meanings and why things happened.
Well, if you explain too much, you've obliterated the process of understanding a work of art. You've done all the work yeah. for the viewers, so why should they bother to do any work on their own, right?
Yes.
How'd you go about making this movie? What was involved?
12 years ago, I didn't know David Lynch, but I contacted a friend of mine who was his assistant on Mulholland Drive and asked him if he would ask Lynch if I could make a film about him. And he said, you know, he kind of laughed and said, oh, there's no way, David's very private. And I said, oh, well, just do me a favor, ask him anyways. And he called back a couple days later saying, you're not going to believe it, but David agreed to let us make a film about him.
Even though he'd never met you?
No, he hadn't met me.
He had met you?
No, he hadn't.
Hadn't?
No.
So why do you think he did?
Maybe because I had the audacity to ask him.
Yeah.
Or I think I went through a friend of his whom he trusted. Mm-hmm. So, you know, together him and I produced and directed these films.
Trust would be a huge issue in a project of this nature.
Trust is key. I mean, it took us a while to get Lynch, took me a while to get Lynch to warm up to the idea. I remember on our first film, which was during the making of Inland Empire, we would ask David questions, and he sat across from us with his arms crossed, smoking a cigarette, giving very terse answers.
Mm-hmm.
And finally he said, you know, pick up the camera, follow me, you'll know what the film is about when it's over.
Mm-hmm.
And from that point to the latest film, The Art Life, our relationship with David has really grown.
Mm-hmm.
And he's learned to trust us and open up a lot more. It took, you know, almost a decade for him to get to this point. And we waited patiently.
You know, for someone like you, a biographer, interviewer, in the process of trying to get someone to open up, there's a lot of being tested involved where, you know, can I trust this guy? How far can I take this? You know, how revealing can I be, right?
Yes. I mean, but it was David had to be honest, and we were also honest.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't manipulate his story, and he didn't, you know, manipulate us. So it was a long process.
I suspect if you had done anything that smacked of manipulation, that would have ended it right there.
Yes, he would have. He would have said something to us. But, you know, he never censored anything in this film. So,
did you get the impression of him as someone who is extremely just tuned in, aware of nuances of behavior around, you know, how people are acting, what's going on around him?
Yes, I think so. David, he's been in business for a very long time, so he's very sensitive to everything. It was hard to interview him because he's gone, you know, for the last four decades, he's been interviewed by the leading publications.
Mm-hmm.
So, we had to kind of approach it very differently.
And he's interviewed by all the leading publications, and I'm sure royally sick of the questions they would ask him.
Yeah, so with this documentary, instead of really asking him a lot of questions, we set up themes, mm-hmm. which allowed him to talk. It was more of a conversation. We would bring up, you know, major themes. Like one day, we would just only talk about his father. We'd go, oh, today's theme is your father. Let's hear stories. And from that, we would gather all the stories that we would use to make the film.
In those stories, were there plenty of hints of the artist that he was to become?
Yes. Yeah, from a very early, that's what I noticed. From a very early age, David Lynch has been drawn towards the art life.
Mm-hmm.
You know, by the time he graduated high school, he's had already gone through, five different private art studios. And the audience doesn't know this, but David went to two different art universities and was an artist before he ever became a filmmaker.
Mm-hmm.
And that's where I think his films are so special, because he treats them as if they're a canvas.
How is he on a set?
I've always noticed David's very detailed-oriented. even though he loves these happy accidents that he talks about, you know, like the character Bob in Twin Peaks was a happy accident. It was one of the workers happened to be hiding behind a bedpost mm-hmm. when he popped up. And David decided to just keep that in Twin Peaks. And so he became one of the scariest characters in, you know, TV history, Bob. But at the same time, he's also very, you know, detailed. Or he does everything himself, a lot of it. You know, he doesn't let just, he comes up with all the designs and all the, you know, he paints, does the costumes. He has his hands over everything. In a way, a control freak.
knows exactly what lens the photographer is using and what the effect will be of that lens.
Yes.
Well, that's, you know, the best way to manage a project of that complexity is to know a little bit about everybody's job, right?
Yeah. Like I said, he treats it like a canvas, so he, in a way, micromanages everything. But that's why his films have a strong mood, and you can almost feel the texture in the films.
Well, it sounds like a fascinating project, John. Thanks very much for talking to us.
Thank you for having me.
John Nguyen is the director of the documentary David Lynch, The Art Life, which will be screened this Thursday and Friday at the Honolulu Museum of Art's Doris Duke Theater in Honolulu. Got a cold wind blowing through my heart.
Support for Hawaii Public Radio comes from Hawaiian Paddle Sports on Maui, providing sustainable eco-tours with a dedication to using business for environmental and social change. HawaiianPaddleSports.com.
In the continuing corruption saga of former HPD chief Louis Kealoha and his city prosecutor wife Catherine Kealoha, newly released records show police commissioner Loretta Sheehan was an early target for the defense. CivilBeat.org reporter Nick Ruby joins us with today's reality check. Hey there, Nick.
Hi, Beth Ann. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for being here. Now, this is about that letter that came from last September, in which Mrs. Kealoha is defending her husband and is also pointing a finger at Police Commissioner Loretta Sheehan. Why?
Well, I think the Kealohas have been trying to defend themselves in many different avenues, such as by filing lawsuits or going to members of the press to try to sort of tell their side of the story as a way to discredit some of the investigators and the allegations that have sort of come to light over the past several years.
The Kealohas have also said that, you know, the media is partly to blame, that things have been leaked to them, in the public's eye at least, there isn't a fair airing of what has happened. From what you have found and having read this latest letter, any evidence to suggest that's true?
Well, I think you have to sort of look at the facts as they are today, and those facts include one police officer who has already pleaded guilty to federal conspiracy and has agreed to cooperate with federal investigators. Now, when you look at the court records in that case, there are a list of other co-conspirators, and one of them, co-conspirator number one, is Catherine Kealoha, based off of the facts that are contained within those court records. So I think that's the best place to start.
So what's the importance of this letter in which she is saying that, you know, Loretta Sheehan should have been disqualified, or at least there are some indications that her attorney would have wanted to have the police commissioner disqualified?
Yeah, well, I mean, there are a couple of important aspects to it. One is that it does allow the Kealohas to sort of put their side of the story out there, right? Because they haven't been talking to the press a lot lately. But then the other way to look at this is the greater context is that former police chief Louis Kealoha is trying to get taxpayers to pay for his legal fees in in a related lawsuit that's sort of tied to this federal corruption probe that's ongoing. And, you know, so there is a bit of a financial incentive to get the police commissioners to sign off on those attorney's fees.
So what's the takeaway from this, at least as far as Loretta Sheehan's concerned?
Well, the takeaway is the saga continues, really. I mean, this has been playing out for years, and it could very well likely last a couple more.
But why? I mean, I'm not sure people understand why perhaps Loretta Sheehan was fingered in this or that seems to be at the center of this particular letter.
Well, remember, the police commission hasn't investigated the police chief on any of these allegations. And Loretta Sheehan's the only police commissioner who came out and was critical of him. And not only in relation to the federal corruption probe, but also in just his general handling of a department that has had high-profile scandal after high-profile scandal.
She's only been in the police commission not even a year. And that was part of what I think was in the letter, too. As you sort of draw back the lens from this, where do you think this goes from here?
Well, from here, I think we wait to see what federal prosecutors are going to do. The investigation has expanded, and we wait to see what the Honolulu Ethics Commission decides on whether Loretta Sheehan can continue to take part in the discussions over whether former police chief Louis Kealoha gets taxpayer-funded legal representation.
All right, the waiting game it is. Thanks so much.
And thank you.
Every day we bring you a reality check from CivilBeat.org, today featuring reporter Nick Ruby. On the world stage, there are some strong women in politics, think Angela Merkel or Theresa May. To that list, you might want to include Dame Jenny Shipley. She was New Zealand's first woman prime minister. She served from December 1997 to the same month in 1999 and left politics shortly after her defeat. She's been involved with business and nonprofit organizations since then. She's coming to Honolulu as part of the East-West Center's Gals with Lei Conference. Lei is an acronym for Leadership, Entrepreneurship, and Inspiration. It's open to the public. She'll also be here, though, to attend a two-day Women Fast Forward Invitational Dialogue of Women Leaders. It's part of the W20 process that informs the G20 on women's advancement. I spoke with Dame Jenny Shipley a few days ago, and I asked her what other women who are on the world stage need better public attention.
There are women everywhere doing amazing things, and we do need to keep putting the case for why women should be in leadership roles. There are a lot of women I know who've been there, and there are a lot of women who I know are wanting to get there. At the moment, there are emerging women in Africa and also in the Pacific who are going to play in increasingly important roles. In Asia, it's a mixed scene. In China, there are some women emerging as mayors and vice mayors, but it's still a huge campaign that needs to be had to get more women into these roles, where they can be both visible, but more importantly, do the work.
We have had long conversations over decades about trying to just have parity for women in the workplace, economically, and the fact that we still, on average, see women who are paid about 75 cents to a man's dollar. And in looking at that scenario and then trying to overlay women in politics or women in leadership, women in the C-suite, what advice do you give women who are either just starting their careers or who may be in mid-career still trying to get what they think they're due?
Oh, look, there are so many things. The first, I think we need to give women every confidence as they enter a role in terms of their negotiation to say who they are and what they're worth. We've got a lot of evidence that often women, particularly when they're returning to the workforce after having their children, they tend not to ask questions like, what is my male peer on for the similar experience and work capability to myself? So I think there are a series of things we need to encourage women to be willing and able to do for themselves. And there are some strategies there that we can share. But we also need the chief executives, whether they're male or female, to be absolutely committed and willing to mind that gap you described. It is completely unjustifiable that, you know, our daughters will be worth less than our sons, and we must make plans to change that. I chair a Champions for Change group here in New Zealand where we've got male and female chairmen and chief executives, and they are absolutely committed but on a learning journey where they're probing hard into their organisations, not just with the theory or the slogans, but going right in to check where the behaviours are. It starts from the top, so if the top changes and expects change, then you do get measurable differences. But you also need really explicit strategies around things like equal pay, and it is a new area of skill and development which we need to share.
I think you're also talking about the skill of being able to negotiate well and believing that you are worth negotiating.
It's true, but we do need to have women feeling empowered. And that is an issue that women and men who want diversity in their organizations so they can serve their customers and consumers well have to put the effort into. In my opinion, customers of the future will not tolerate organizations who do not reflect that inclusive and diverse mindset and skill set and offering. They'll also expect services that are empathetic, and I haven't yet seen an organization that can deliver that if they're not capable of understanding the real meaning of a diverse and socially inclusive, committed organization. I mean, when you see these differences in either companies or corporations, they are on fire relative to others. People want to work there, they want to be there, they feel valued, their customers are attracted toward them. You get a whole series of convergence of advantage. So I am tired of having to argue the theory, although that case still has to be made. I think we need to really move very quickly to getting strategies in place and getting high levels of ownership. So coming back to these chief executives, they are now in the public arena saying they know for the future of their shareholders they need to champion this change. Now that's a breakthrough. Rather than women telling these people that change is required, they've put the jersey on, so to speak. They are wanting to champion this change. And finally, without quotas, the numbers are moving.
What about women helping other women? We're sometimes told that that seems to be a difficulty, and that it's strange in a way to understand.
It must never be a difficulty. Women have both the most wonderful opportunity to mentor their peers or receive mentoring from their peers, and I would never have been Prime Minister of New Zealand or indeed a corporate leader today had I not had a wonderful set of both political and corporate role models, and indeed a lot of friends and supporters who are not necessarily leaders but want women in the lead. So I think there's the two elements. We need to make it both expected and acceptable that women will take leadership roles, and we then need both sides, the experienced leadership mentoring and the support, so each woman can develop her own leadership identity. And whatever that is and wherever she seeks to take it, it's hers. And I think that if we allow women and give them the license, the social license, to be an assured leader with an identity that they wish to take forward into multiple roles, then that's when you start getting both the personal switch, and then if you deal with issues like bias, unconscious and otherwise, in the community and in the media and in the political environment, and out it. We've got to talk about this and name it for what it is, and expect people to engage in a conversation rather than becoming defensive and arguing why it should not occur. So there are many fronts we still need to fight this cause on. But actually the prize is in a better society or better corporations satisfying their customers well and driving far better revenue returns. Because we've now got research that shows where you've got diverse leadership, that's women and men capable of working together, bringing their whole selves, understanding opportunity and risk. These companies thrive. They get further, and when there are crises, they fall less far. So why wouldn't we do this? But I think today, and certainly in our conference this coming week, we'll share strategies, but we'll also put the case. which is so compelling as to why wouldn't we all rush to turn our minds to this. And I do hope that the G20 countries will see that in enabling the economies and their people and communities, they will put this at the center, not at the periphery, of the issues that need to be dealt with in order to shape a proper future for us all.
From that global perspective, you can also pull back a little bit and just focus on the United States. Do you think that that perspective is alive and well, given some of the change that we've seen happen since the last election?
Look, I think it's a mix, and I'm not a specialist in the U.S., although I'm a close observer. You've got significant women in politics on both sides of the House today. Certainly your numbers are changing and shifting forward in terms of CEOs, you know, slower than we would all like, but there is progress being made. I am deeply concerned everywhere worldwide when I see the rhetoric change, and it is unacceptable and inexcusable that the language of today is not inclusive language. It is biased or judgmental language. And I think we all need to both engage in and take responsibility for ensuring that that doesn't deteriorate, because it does then impact on the willingness and ability of women to participate equally in society. And I'm sure that that is not the outcome that anyone expects or is desirable.
I wish we had more time to talk, Dame Jenny, but I thank you so much for the time today.
My pleasure.
And have a very good and safe trip to our shores.
I look forward to joining you in Hawaii and to meeting the women, both former leaders and the leaders who will help us deal with these issues in the future.
Dame Jenny Shipley is a former Prime Minister of New Zealand and now an independent speaker tracking global megatrends with particular expertise in the Asia-Pacific region. She'll be in Hawaii this week for several East-West Center programs on advancing women's empowerment, including the East-West Center's third annual Gals with Lei, that would be Leadership, Entrepreneurship, and Inspiration Forum. That happens Thursday, the 29th. More information about it is on our Facebook page, The Conversation.
Support for Stargazer comes from Ferraro Choi, designer of the NOAA Daniel K. Inouye Regional Center, providing environmentally sustainable architecture, interior design, and research for projects throughout Hawaii and the Pacific. FerraroChoi.com.
Stargazer time, our weekly look at what's happening in the massive universe around our tiny planet and what we can try to observe in our dark island skies. As usual, we're turning to the expertise of Christopher Phillips and welcoming him back right now. Hey, Christopher, welcome back. What do you have for us this week?
Hey, Dave, good to be here. For this week, stargazers, look out for Mars in the western sky, close to the sun during sunset. Jupiter and Saturn will also be visible in the southern sky right through to the early morning. Now, the moon is going to be just a crescent this week.
And we're learning about a new study into gravitational waves?
That's right. So back in 2015, we reported that gravitational waves had been detected for the first time by the LIGO experiment. LIGO stands for Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory. LIGO was designed to detect gravitational waves emitted by objects in the distant universe. These waves were predicted by Einstein, but up until 2015, they had never been detected. LIGO was a huge breakthrough. Now, building on the success of LIGO, the European Space Agency has given the green light to an awesome new mission called LISA, Laser Interferometer Space Antenna. LISA is going to take the hunt for gravitational waves into space.
And these waves are invisible, right? They're not like light. How are they detected?
That's true. They are invisible, but LISA has a really cool method to detect them. LISA is composed of three spacecraft. They will fly into orbit and arrange themselves in a large triangle formation. Once they are in formation, they will shoot laser beams at each other.
Like a security system with the laser, when they cross the laser, they detect them?
Actually, you're not too far off. The lasers can be disturbed by incoming gravitational waves. Imagine being on a boat on a nice, calm day. Now, if the boat was to be hit by a wave, even a small one, it would bob up and down, right?
I get it. So if a gravitational wave passes through the triangle, it'll cause the laser to move a little bit.
Yep, there's a little bit more quantum mechanics to it, but essentially, yes. By studying how the laser changes, we can determine how strong the wave is.
Kind of like a gravitational wave security system in space.
You got it, absolutely.
And is this possibly a new way of dealing with astronomy research and expansion of the concept of using telescopes?
That's the plan. Right now, we're still a long way from using this as a reliable way to collect data, but a few years down the line, gravitational wave astronomy is going to be huge.
It's Christopher Phillips and another fascinating stargazer. Thank you.
You are welcome, Dave.
And I'm Dave Lawrence. Catch you next week.
This morning we went underwater in search of a specific puffer fish with unique defense mechanisms. When agitated, puffers will inflate into a large ball and secrete a chemical that make it unpalatable to predators. The organs of these fish accumulate a toxin called tetrodotoxin that is deadly to humans. Despite the danger, puffer fish are a delicacy in Japan, where licensed chefs safely prepare it for the table. Today, we ask you to name a specific type of puffer found in Hawaii. It's usually dark brown or black and covered in white spots. This chunky fish is called the spotted puffer, or the o'opu hue. And that's today's quiz. Somebody get that?
We did.
All right.
Chris, we had a winner. Christina Swenson Stewart called us from Kailua and knew the answer. Gets the prize, and we thank you very much for playing the backyard quiz. Now, if you've got a quiz question for us, you can always send it in to talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org, and you just might hear it on a future show.
Support for the backyard quiz comes from Achieve 3000, wishing all students, parents, teachers, and administrators an enjoyable summer, providing opportunities for student summer reading with Achieve Hawaii Home Access. Achieve3000.com/Hawaii.
Even the most seasoned actors can feel the need to revise their craft. Their skill set depends on their ability to intuit the nuances of human behavior, and those are skills that can never be perfected, only improved. Actor Courtney Kosten hones her craft and helps others do the same through workshops like the one she's about to begin at the Actors Group in Honolulu. And Courtney's with us in our studio. Thanks for coming in, Courtney.
Oh, thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be here.
What kind of things happen at a workshop? You know, you have actors of varying degrees of experience and skill, right?
We do, yes. This is actually going to be the third workshop we've had at TAG. The first workshop we really was geared towards just sort of acting in general. We like to have in-depth discussion about what's good acting versus bad acting and why we see that.
Mm-hmm.
And then we also, I really wanted to give them the opportunity to be able to perform. Usually when you take classes or you do workshops, you just sort of have a condensed version. You learn everything, and then you're done at the end. But for me, a lot of my learning expertise, a lot of my the backbone of my experience really came from being able to perform in front of a group of people. It changes
sure.
so differently. So, so I really wanted them to be able to have that experience. So what we did is we worked on scenes and monologues, and at the end of the 6 weeks, we just opened it up to friends and family. They came in to see, we called it our performance showcase,
mm-hmm.
and to just see what they've been working on. And then the second class was a little bit more in-depth for acting exercises or acting techniques. We worked a lot with Stanford Meiser, Stella Adler, and Michael Chekhov, just learning the different styles and just kind of figuring out what works for everybody.
Those being the three of the prevailing kind of schools of mm-hmm. thought about method acting or formal Chekhovian acting, whatever, right?
Mm-hmm.
Those are kind of some of the established pathways.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And based on those, I mean, those also need to be adapted to the material, right?
Yes, absolutely. You know, it would be very difficult to take something from Chekhov, say, and maybe do, something a little bit more contemporary. So
yeah.
Each one is really written and specified for a specific genre of theater.
You know, I want to go back to something you said at the beginning, good acting versus bad acting, because everybody's got an opinion about that.
Absolutely.
You know, there's no one who doesn't feel qualified to judge whether somebody's a good or a bad actor.
Absolutely.
Right?
And Chris, you said you're a musician, so, you know, you don't have to be skilled, really, to hear someone play music and to know if that person's necessarily good or bad.
That's a good point.
So, yeah, right. And I think acting is the same way. You know, you sort of go and you have this experience, and so we just wanted to be able to pinpoint it. We wanted to start that conversation as when I go see something, was that a choice that maybe the actor made? Was that something that the playwright wrote? Was that a director's choice? So just trying to kind of figure out and go, why did they make that decision, and why didn't it work for me, or why did it work for me?
And if it did work for you, it's because of some version of it was real.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. And that was the majority of the consensus was, you know, when I see good acting, it feels natural. It really kind of keeps me connected to the moment. It doesn't feel phony.
You're not supposed to even know it's
being exactly.
done.
Yeah, right.
Which can make it a little bit tricky to teach or to encourage, I would think.
Yeah, absolutely. And you know, and that's another reason, going back to the performance workshop or the performance showcase, is, you know, even if you spend weeks and weeks through a rehearsal process, your energy level changes quite differently when you've got someone in the audience for the first time.
Oh,
so, you know, even if you feel like you've got it narrowed down and, you know, you're 100%, all of a sudden you bring another aspect into the theater and you have this live energy, it changes everything for you, so...
You can be in front of an audience that gives you the energy to just sail through a performance.
Absolutely, yes.
Or you can be in front of an audience that you just, every time you look at them, you think, oh my God, you know, I'm dying out here.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Yeah, it's you feed very much off of the energy of the audience. You can tell when they're engaged and they're excited, or, you know, when they're hurt for you. And
what do you do in the latter case?
Oh gosh. Well, you know, there's not a whole lot. Hopefully you've got either a director or an ASM who will come behind stage and say, gosh, our pace is a little low, or, you know, and then there's times where we've had a show and we just thought, gosh, that didn't go very well. They didn't really seem connected. I didn't think they liked it. And then after the show, you know, you have people come up and say, wow, this is really fantastic. We didn't even really know how to respond in the moment. So,
well, that's the other thing.
I think it varies people's response, you know, especially with theater. I don't think a lot of people you know, spend time in a lot of live theater. Everything we see is at the movie theater. So they're not sure if they can vocally, you know, go gasp or when that moment arrives. I don't know if they know that they're able to do that, and that it helps feed the actors as well.
But if you're not getting fed, you can't just stop, right?
You've got to absolutely. The show must go on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So what do you draw on there? You just draw on your technique, I would think.
Yeah, your technique. And, you know, a lot of it comes down to muscle memory, you know, just continuing. You don't want to change things. You know, you want to do it as you've rehearsed it, because for the majority of the audience, hopefully that does work.
Yeah.
So, yeah, just sticking to the plan.
But and not tripping over what other people might be thinking. Or
absolutely.
Not thinking.
Yeah, absolutely.
That's a big part of that, too,
sure.
I would think.
Mm-hmm.
Once you've done the things you've, say, described in your first two workshops, and as you develop a third workshop, let's say someone has been to the previous two, what's left to discuss in an upcoming workshop?
Yeah, no, I'm really glad you brought that up. So I've had people, a continuous group of people that have signed up for each individual workshop. And for this particular workshop, I really wanted to cater towards the people that have really enjoyed the workshops and are ready to get out into the community to start to audition for things. So I wanted to provide a little bit of the backbone for them, blocking, how to take direction, you know, sort of the different positions or roles in the theater, what the director does, what the set design team, you know, is primarily responsible for. And just so that they have a general backbone. And then we're also going to work through acting. We still wanted to incorporate acting, but we're going to do some scene work as well.
Mm-hmm. So mixing in a lot of practical nuts and bolts.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's different, too. When you go see a show, you know, when you have the background information of, oh, wow, who made that decision, or, you know, a light cue or a sound cue, everything really sort of incorporates. But if you're not aware of those individual little things, sometimes when you watch it, you just don't know.
Always more to learn, huh?
Yeah, absolutely. Always more to learn.
Courtney, thanks much for coming
in. Thanks, Chris, so much for having me. I appreciate it.
Courtney Costin will conduct a 6-week acting workshop at the Actors Group's Brad Powell Theater beginning this Sunday, July 1st, and you can find details on our Facebook page, The Conversation. There's always a lot going on around the state, and Morning Edition host and colleague Derek Malama joins us for a look at events going on in our community that might be a little under the radar. And Derek, I bet a few weeks ago, not too many of us knew what a king tide was.
Not at all.
That's all changed, hasn't it?
Yes.
But what else are we going to learn?
Well, how about ocean acidification?
Okay.
And that's where carbon dioxide in the atmosphere is absorbed by the world's oceans. A marine biologist says this will result in changes to the chemistry and acidity of seawater. So Christopher Wall will discuss how this affects coral reefs tomorrow at 3:30 in the Waikiki Aquarium, and this is free.
I suspect that's probably kind of a cautionary tale about the state of the oceans as well.
Right. I mean, I never knew about king tides, you know, 2 months ago.
See, that's why we do this, Derek.
Right, right.
And, you know, one of our good friends and a frequent guest on this show is Jeff Geer, storyteller.
Yes, and he'll give you the backstory of what he does tomorrow. He'll talk about storytelling here in Hawaii and around the world in this free Meet the Artist presentation. So you can meet Jeff Geer tomorrow at noon in the Hawaii State Art Museum. This is free. And bring your own lunch, and you can have it while Jeff tells stories.
We can pretty much guarantee that'll be a lively time.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And there's an event tomorrow in the Orvis Auditorium that combines music, video, and a well-known science writer.
Right. It's called Perpetual Motion, Galileo and His Revolutions. It features soprano Sarah Pillow, also Marianne Ballard and Daniel Swenberg, and author Deva Sobel will narrate the story of revolutions that were taking place both in science and music back in the 17th century. So it's like a whole bunch of things happening at the same time. There's also like a video thing happening too. So it's tomorrow at 7:30 in the Orvis Auditorium at UH. It's free, but tickets are required, and there's a link on our website.
Some history with period-appropriate music as well.
Mm-hmm.
Thanks a lot, Derek.
Oh, you're welcome.
Derek Malama joins the conversation to take a closer look at events in our community under the radar. You can always find out more on our website, hawaiipublicradio.org.
Support for the conversation comes from Sacred Hearts Academy, a private school for girls in grades preschool through high school, where the focus is on science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Learn more at sacredhearts.org.
And that about wraps up the show for us. And welcome back to Chris Vandercook. Nice to have you
back.
Hey,
Bethan.
Now, tomorrow, we're going to sit down with HPU President John Gotama, and we'll also hear from Bike Chair Hawaii CEO Lori McCarney.
And we'll get a preview of the Palikū Theater's production of James and the Giant Peach with Dr. Pam DeBoer.
You can email us at talkback@hawaiipublicradio.org if there's something you want us to know. You can also post comments on Facebook at The Conversation or tweet us at HI Conversation or say hello to me at BKOZHPR.
If you missed any of this show or want a past one, find them on The Conversation page with links to more information about guests and topics. Just look under Talk Shows for The Conversation on HawaiiPublicRadio.org. I'm Chris Vandercook.
I'm Beth Ann Koslovich. We'll meet you tomorrow with more of The Conversation. See you then.